Welcome to Advanced Nuclear, the official podcast of UCAN Power, where leading experts, innovators, and policymakers explore the latest developments shaping the future of nuclear energy.
Welcome to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Howe for UCAN Power. We're here to talk about bringing cutting-edge nuclear technologies to market to bolster our energy and national security. When it comes to growing nuclear power generation in the United States and around the world, setting the right policies is essential. Last year, we saw significant bipartisan legislation signed into law to support reactor deployment and to streamline regulatory processes. And just recently, the Trump administration issued a spate of executive orders related to nuclear demonstration and deployment. Bringing nuclear power plants to market is neither cheap nor easy, which makes the imperative for crafting and implementing sound and supportive policies all the more essential. We have a very special guest today, someone who has been immersed in nuclear policymaking for quite some time and who has boatloads of expertise and wisdom when it comes to the nuclear industry. He can help sort out what policies make sense and how best to catalyze robust nuclear power expansion. Dan Poneman has a distinguished career, and his resume is so long it would take the entire podcast to spell it out. Suffice it to say that he's been the longest-serving Deputy Secretary of Energy since the creation of DOE, is the former CEO of Centrus Energy Corp, an essential and innovative uranium enrichment company that has roots going back to the birth of the nuclear industry, has served for years as a defense and nonproliferation expert on the National Security Council, has written eloquently on nuclear matters through books, op-eds, and articles, sits on numerous academic and corporate boards and panels, and has received a multitude of national and international honors for his work on behalf of the civil nuclear power industry. In full disclosure, I spent several years working for Dan at Centrus Energy and tell you that there is no one in Washington with such incredible passion, drive, and devotion to bringing nuclear power to market for the benefit of our nation and the world. He's truly a whirlwind of energy and ideas, and it's an honor to bring his great experience and deep thinking on nuclear matters to this show. So, Mr. Secretary, Dan, thank you for taking the time to join us on the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. We really appreciate you being here.
Delighted to be with you, Jim.
So I understand there's an anniversary this year regarding you and nuclear issues. Please tell us your backstory. When and how did you get involved in nuclear energy policy?
Actually, Jim, I was just reminded this will be an anniversary in about 2 weeks. It will be the 50th anniversary of when I came to Washington as a summer intern for John Glenn. And I'm from Ohio. And I was giving a talk last week in the Russell Senate office building. I recalled, you know, Russell S-204. And I was assigned into the basement running the auto pen. And after my freshman year of college, after about 2 or 3 weeks of the auto pen, I was very good at forging John Glenn's signature. However, I wasn't learning anything, right? So I asked for a research project. And they said, sure, like on what? And I said, like, anything. And they said, all right, kid, well, why don't you go look into the NPT? And I go, I'm on it. Now, of course, Jim, 50 years ago, there was no internet, there was no Google, there was no search, nothing. I went down to the Congressional Research Service Library Annex in Russell. And I think by the end of the day, I did find NPT stood for Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I've been working on that stuff ever since.
Well, that's amazing because the amount of expertise you bring is really a foundation we can build a lot of policies on. It's rare in many industries to have people who stick around long enough to really apply their expertise to the policymaking world. And you found yourself at the top of that world. Now, you've recently joined as a co-chair of the Nuclear Energy and National Security Consortium, NENSC. It's a nonprofit that, like UCAN Power, you know, sees the vital role of nuclear energy in American security and prosperity. Our listeners can check you out at nensc.org. Please tell us more about NENSC and the policy priorities that you're working on.
NENSC came together a few years ago because there was a large community of people who, like you and like me, believe deeply in the role of nuclear energy, but not only as an energy form, but also as a critical component to U.S. national security, right? Because as you well know, and with your distinguished career, the Navy relies on nuclear power for both our carriers and our submarines to, you know, sustain our deterrent, deter our adversaries, defend our allies and our homeland and so forth. And as our former Secretary of Energy, Ernie Moniz, has published, a very useful study from 2017. There's an ecosystem between nuclear energy and national security. All those young kids, we need to be very focused on operating reactors effectively and safely, and submarines and carriers need to know, or they ought to know, that after they serve their nation in uniform, they've got a nice industry to go to have them sustain their families and so forth. So the industry really depends on that, you know, brilliant and dedicated workforce coming out of the nuclear Navy. And it's a virtuous cycle because the Navy is able to recruit based on knowing that there's a commercial industry out there to support their people, and the commercial industry can rely on the talent pool. And in our own company, you and I work together at Centris, I'm sure you'll agree that, you know, no greater group of talented individuals on our workforce were those beyond the Navy veterans, who were just terrific and just always delivered excellent work and were critical. So NENSC, as we call it, Nuclear Energy and National Security Coalition, basically leveraged that commitment. And so we've got a bunch of experts. We've done useful things with other folks. And full disclosure, we worked very recently with your group, UCAN, on a letter to the ranking and chairs of the both House and Senate Armed Services Committees to promote advanced nuclear energy, which is a one kind of thing we do. We've also done some webinars with the former National Nuclear Security Administration leader, Lisa Gordon Haggerty, with a former NRC chair, Dick Meserve. And so we want to both provide a convening place for people who share this kind of dual commitment to national security and nuclear energy, and also a way to sort of help educate people who want to become more involved or more interested.
Yeah, and I can't commend more highly to our audience the webinars that you do. They're very informative. They're very well orchestrated. So please check them out at nensc.org and sign up for the next webinar. They're really worth your while. A little bit related is the relationship, though, between government and industry. And you've kind of seen it all from both sides of the ledger here. How do you view that relationship today? Is government-industry collaboration where it needs to be, or is a closer relationship needed?
I think we're working in a good direction. And nuclear is different, right? Nuclear was born as a government technology. Nuclear technology was born, and the Manhattan Project was born in national security. So government has always had and will always have an unusually, if you will, outsized role in this industry, if for no other reason than the inherent duality of nuclear fission from a physics standpoint says the same technology that can be used to generate steam can also be used to generate mushroom clouds, right? So you just have to be thoughtful about regulating this, and that will always be critical. The nuclear Navy, as you well know, was actually the driving force behind the nuclear industry to begin with. It was the legendary leadership of Admiral Hyman Rickover that led to the selection of the light water reactor design that fueled the initial submarines, the Nautilus and all of its successors. And then a little less known story is that they actually canceled an aircraft carrier that was going to be built and ended up with a couple of reactors lying extra. And so it was Rickover who went to Duquesne Light Company in Pennsylvania and said, hey, how'd you like to build a commercial nuclear power plant? So that became that same light water reactor design. That became the cornerstone for all 104, up to 112 now, 94 reactors we have operating. So when you think about it, that Navy impetus led to now there's like 90-plus reactors floating around on carriers and submarines, and another 94 operating reactors. So it was really, you know, incredible contribution. However, we now have a commercial industry. They have had flat demand for a couple of decades, but now with all of the AI revolution and other reasons, the electrification of transportation and so forth, there's been a vertiginous spike. So industry has played and must continue to play a critical role. So the I don't want to go on too long here, but the interesting thing and the important thing now is how they interact and how they have interacted. Government has provided both a customer, as we've talked about for the nuclear Navy, government has provided investment through the Loan Program Office, which got Project Vogtle going, through the production tax credits that are now keeping the existing fleet going, and through appropriations, which we'll talk about more in this podcast, and then third, as a regulator. So they're a customer, they're an investor, and they're a regulator. And these public-private partnerships, I think, are going to be pivotal because as we enter a new phase of the nuclear industry with a whole new generation of reactors, we need to take risks. And there are going to be first-of-a-kind costs that are never easy for the private sector to stomach. And that's where government comes in. It's happened historically with other industries like solar, photovoltaics, and so forth. So if the government can help defray the costs of first-of-a-kind deployment, then private capital and the private sector can do the rest.
That all makes sense. You've mentioned Congress a couple of times, and I know you've got a lot of experience working with Congress. That's where you kind of got your start with nuclear policy. Where do you see things right now? I mean, we know that there's a lot of bipartisan support for nuclear. Is that really strong and deep support, or is it somewhat more fragile and perhaps illusory? What's your view on that?
I think it's strong and deep. It's almost, to me, a pinch-me kind of situation, because the Nuclear Fuel Security Act of 2023 passed 96-3 in the Senate. The Advance Act, which had the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reforms, passed 88-2. And nowadays, with politics being as riven as they are by partisanship, I would wonder if you introduced a bill saying the sun rises in the east if you generate that kind of majority. Why is that? It's not sentiment. It's not anything other than both parties, I think, at a very profound level, recognize the importance of nuclear energy. There is one trick to this, perhaps, and I've said this in the book that I published back in 2019, Double Jeopardy, a plug. And the line in the book was, people can agree on what to do even if they don't agree on why. Because you might care passionately about climate change and recognize the simple arithmetic that you're not going to be effective in combating climate change without a lot more nuclear. But you might not really care about military stuff, just say, right? Or you might care a lot about defending the homeland and deterring bad guys and believe the United States needs a robust nuclear security infrastructure to support both our naval reactors and our nuclear weapons arsenal and support a strong nuclear complex for those reasons. And so when you add up, you know, those two groups, and I'm sure there's many in between, you end up with these huge majorities. I think they're robust, and I think it's critical that they are robust because, as you well know, Jim, the timelines of deploying anything nuclear are measured in years and sometimes decades. And therefore, if you don't have strong bipartisan support, you're going to have a problem.
Which brings us back, I think, to the very dawn of the nuclear age when you had very robust bipartisan support. And then that kind of frittered away with certain things happening in the 70s and 80s. But we're kind of right back to where we started, which is, I think, a very good place to be. But let's talk again about the executive branch. You know, we're recording this podcast just a few days after the administration, the Trump administration issued four executive orders dealing with how to rapidly expand the use of nuclear power in America and around the world. I'm not putting you on the spot and saying if you've read these EOs in detail yet, but what's your general perception about the fact that the administration has issued four EOs in the first place?
I think it's great. I think that the four EOs, and I have not studied the text all the way through. I've read the fact sheets and so forth. I think they hit the right issues. I think it's extremely important to get Nuclear Regulatory Commission reform. More red tape does not mean more safety. And, you know, it's a bit of a historical excursion, Jim. I know you're a history buff, as am I. But I was around, and I remember the Energy Reorganization Act of 1974. And the premise was the Atomic Energy Commission, which was the successor to the Manhattan Project, at that time had responsibility to promote nuclear energy and to regulate its safety. And the Congress says, no, that's a conflict of interest. And so what happened was they split, obviously, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had took the safety function, and the promotional aspect stayed in what became the Department of Energy. And there are people who have argued, you know, like that was like a big mistake from day one, because it basically gave the NRC all the responsibility and burden to worry about safety, but none of the responsibility to worry about like energy and solving problems, right? And so they said, look, you know, the Federal Aviation Authority, they both regulate safety and promote civil aviation. The Food and Drug Administration both promotes beneficial use of drugs, but make sure they're safe. So long story short, I think these reforms for the NRC are long overdue. I particularly welcome the reference to science-based as opposed to passion-based or politically-based regulations. Streamlining nuclear reactor testing, super important. We're just like way too slow on that. If you look at the demand curves for nuclear energy, we're not, I beg your pardon, for electricity based on the AI revolution, if we have a prayer of winning that race, especially against a very vigorous competitor in the form of China, we just got to speed things up. So that's great. I've advocated for many years, including in my book, for deploying advanced nuclear on both military bases and Department of Energy reservations, where you need 724 reliable power for be it supercomputers or military installations that you don't want bad guys to be able to hack into your SCADA systems and stop you. So also, I think it's hard to prove, I'd say impossible to prove the business case for small modular unless you order a bunch of them. And that's why governments were instituted among men, to use a historical phrase. So I think the role of the government in deploying a number, a substantial number of advanced nuclear reactors is super important. And then the last, you know, saving the best for last, the executive order on reinvigorating the nuclear industrial supply base. That's music to my ears, because you and I labored in those vineyards for a long time, and our supply chain has just completely broken down. And to do things in that area, and especially the one you and I worked on together, uranium enrichment, is like way overdue.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that, because I think that's a really vital part. You know, people, they like to buy cars, but they never think of what goes into the supply chains to make those cars, and of course the fuel supply chains, and it's just absolutely critical. I did want to ask, though, about non-proliferation. One of the arguments we have against nuclear writ large is that, you know, it can lead to bad, you know, bad things like nuclear weapon states emerging out of nowhere. But you've got a pretty strong argument that nuclear exports from the U.S., you know, reduce worldwide non-proliferation risk or proliferation risk. Other people argue the opposite. So please set the record straight. You know, how do U.S. nuclear exports reduce the risk of illicit nuclear proliferation?
Yeah, happy to answer that. I think it's pretty straightforward, but I think it's important, you know, to start by, if you will, I think, questioning the premise of the opposite view. I mean, there is a simple but incorrect tautology that nuclear equals proliferation equals dangerous, and that there's not really a meaningful distinction between civil nuclear and a dedicated military program. And you and I both know that civil nuclear programs are not the principal vector of proliferation, right? There is an exception, perhaps, that proves the rule. The thing that got me involved in the Glenn era was the Indian so-called peaceful nuclear explosion, when India did, in fact, divert peaceful assistance from both the U.S. and Canada. But the principal vector for weapons programs has been weapon programs, right? And it's like stealing technology like AQ Condit and giving it to bad guys like North Korea and Iran and so forth. So it's to use a multi-billion dollar civil reactor program that's under IAEA safeguards as a cover for a weapons program is like the dumbest way to go about it. So I think the premise is flawed. But let's talk about U.S. exports. I remember during the Bush 43 administration, and I do believe bipartisanship is important, the second longest serving Deputy Secretary of Energy, Clay Sell, asked a bunch of us in to talk about something that became known as the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. And I made the argument there, and I still believe today, that, look, if nuclear exists globally, and we have over 400 reactors, whether you love it or hate it, you got to want it to be safe, and you got to want to stop bombs, okay? And if you care about those two things, you want U.S. leadership, because without being jingoistic, U.S. safety standards and U.S. nonproliferation standards are second to none. So every time, Jim, that you export U.S. nuclear fuel, every time that you export U.S. nuclear reactors, they carry a little flag on them. It says, Atomic Energy Act blessed under the Section 123, the most robust nonproliferation rules in the world are those standards. And since now the Russian order book for reactors globally is $200 billion and the U.S. order book in round numbers is the roundest, as in zero, although we have hopes in Poland and Bulgaria and elsewhere, we really need those U.S. exports to get out there. As Secretary Monisi is saying, no exports, no influence. So I want the nonproliferation rules applied around the world. We have not just the U.S., but we have now over 30 countries pledging to triple nuclear capacity. Those should be American reactors with American nonproliferation standards. I don't think there's any question that no other country in the world can match them.
Well, that's a call to arms, it sounds like to me. So let's get on that bandwagon. Now, the Biden administration set a very ambitious goal of tripling nuclear. You referenced that by 2050. The Trump administration is now looking to quadruple nuclear capacity in the United States by mid-century, with 10 new large reactors under construction by 2030 here in the States. You know, these are very ambitious goals. A lot of things are going to have to happen right to make that possible. In your view, what are the most important steps that we need to take now to make such a nuclear resurgence possible?
Well, I think, Jim, I think everyone has to do their part. Let me just say one thing I haven't said yet about industry. You know what industry has to do? Execute. Industry has so hobbled, and I don't want to throw rocks or say who struck John or why, but the case of Vogtle, for example, was very slow and over budget. Inevitably so in the case of building the first new reactors after a 3-year hiatus. Fair enough. But if the industry gets this opportunity based, for example, on these four executive orders and the congressional legislation to follow, they've got to deliver. We need really good people, and we got to build up that talent pool and the supply chain. So I would say, you know, basically everybody's going to have a role. What is it going to take? It's going to take government doing all those things that I've already mentioned. We need the government as a customer and in the form of DOD and possibly DOE. We need smarter, leaner, meaner, but effective regulation, right? And we need government leadership in getting U.S. reactors sold internationally, apropos your last question. So that's on the government side. So, you know, regulator, customer, investor, we need a continuation of the tax credits and the other forms of financial support, loans and so forth. But then the industry really has got to deliver. And when I say the industry, let's include the unions. You know, I had the honor to serve with Sean McGarvey, and I've worked with many other union leaders on this other commission I recently co-chaired with Sherry Goodman, Commission on Nuclear Energy and American Leadership, which hopefully you can make your listeners aware of. And the unions really do a fantastic job of training people. Everyone doesn't have to have a PhD and a master's degree in engineering, but we definitely need a robust and skilled workforce. So that workforce, the industry training, the supply chain that used to be quite robust, but with the loss of leadership, it attenuated and eroded. These are the things that all have to come together. And you know, if we do this right, we can really have an awesome future for nuclear.
You bring up some really good points there. When we look at what's happening in the industry, we've got a lot of the what they call Generation 3 Plus light water reactors, such as the AP1000, but you know, smaller versions such as the BWRX-300 that General Electric Hitachi is deploying up in Canada, and now it looks like at TVA as well, which is a really good sign. But these are light water reactors. We've also got the Generation 4 advanced reactors that don't use water as a coolant. You know, you've got sodium-cooled reactors and high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, that sort of thing. The question, though, is that will the success of the Gen 3 Plus light water reactors kind of displace the Generation 4 reactors for a period of time as people take kind of a time-trusted technology and bring it to market rather than the more kind of adventurous technologies that you have? And they're very safe. Most of them are inherently safe, the Gen 4 reactors, but they haven't been really commercialized yet. So do you see them being able to operate or develop in parallel, or is this going to be a displacement where Gen 4 is going to have to take a back seat for a little while until, you know, fuel supply chains, that sort of thing, build up?
Well, just first, a brief caveat. You mentioned at the outset, but I am on the board of one of these companies. So, you know, just for the interest of transparency, I'll say that. But I will make these generic comments. And I don't know why, but when you're framing the question, Jim, I thought of sort of to make the point, 737 was operating very well. Did Boeing stop developing the 787? No, right? So if even a fraction of the projected demand pans out, I mean, the numbers are staggering. Data centers in the United States alone for AI, according to McKinsey, required, if memory serves, 21 gigawatts last year. And by 2030, they're talking about 70 gigawatts. That's like 50 Vogels, okay? So there is plenty of market out there, right? And so the way I think about it, Jim, is it's not surprising and it's logical and it's fine that, you know, familiar technologies with familiar supply chains and familiar fuel forms and familiar regulations should be getting out there. But it would be crazy to stop developing these Gen 4 reactors, which have, you know, really impressive parameter shifts, like, you know, liquid metal cooled reactors. That's one of the ones I'm on the board of. But, you know, liquid sodium that's used by TerraPower and Oklo and others, you know, very high melting point. So you can operate these reactors at ambient pressures, inherently safer, right? Great conductors of electricity. Forms, metallic fuel forms that expand when they overheat means the natural reactivity goes down instead of goes up like it did at Chernobyl. So it would be nuts to sacrifice the enhanced performance characteristics of fourth generation because you're doing okay on generation 3 plus. And as I said, the demand is certainly robust that all of these, there should be room. And I guess one last point is a lot of these different reactors have different sizes and various performance parameters that mean they will have different customers and different applications. So it's not just like a Manichaean struggle, you know, between or like two scorpions in a bottle. There are use cases to take, you know, one example, the Gen 4 reactors have higher outlet temperatures and can support industrial processes and not just electricity generation. So that's, you know, that's a case in point. Or, you know, you might need a reactor to be very small for a remote community in Canada or mobile or whatever. So I think there's plenty of room in the market for all of these.
Well, I think we're in violent agreement on that. And I totally, I'm glad you brought up the point about the other use cases aside from just electricity generation is if you want to, whether you want to decarbonize, you know, some of your heavy industry in America, or you just want to assure them reliable, always on power, you know, nuclear is the way to go. And that's why it's so encouraging to see companies, either hyperscalers or some in the steel industry and other major, you know, large chemical industries like Dow working with X Energy. I think these are really, really good signs that we're kind of headed in a very good direction. But which brings up, you know, the question of money. And, you know, any major expansion of nuclear energy capacity is going to be expensive. And a quadrupling of nuclear energy capacity is going to be, you know, enormously so. You know, where will the capital to build all these plants come from? Is this going to be a government thing? Is it going to be a purely private sector play? Is it going to be a mix of the two? What's your thoughts on that?
I have a slightly heterodox view on this topic. I've heard repeated in a mantra-like fashion the line that the nuclear expansion will be government-enabled but industry-led. Sorry, I think it's exactly the opposite. It will be government-led and industry-enabled. What do I mean by that? As I said, nuclear is unique. It comes out of government. Government is a driving force. You see this in the executive orders. And in a case where we're effectively starting over because of the basic atrophy of the overall industry, we're really at early stages. And anytime you're moving into first-of-a-kind deployments, things are very expensive. And that is, in fact, why governments exist. If there is a very long payback, if you know there's going to be cost overruns on the first few cases, but that once the industry gets on its feet, then the private sector can take over, I think that's going to happen here. And there's an object lesson. If you look in 2009, 2010, there were zero grid-scale solar PV plants in the United States of America. Now, everyone knew that solar panels worked. They had traversed what was known as the first valley of death. Does it work? But the second valley of death of commercial scale-up had not been traversed. And private capital was scared and wouldn't invest. And then comes the Recovery Act because of the financial crisis. And then these vast sums, like $30 billion, became available for loan program. And I had the honor to lead that as the chair of the Credit Review Board. And the U.S. government, through that program, supported the first five solar PV plants at scale. And guess what happened? Private sector said, oh, it works. And then private capital came in. And by the way, they came in at the same time. Because if you take something that's risky and the government says, I'll go halvesies with you, boy, that reduces the risk for the private sector. So in my view, that combination of things like the loan program, both investment and production tax credits, the enrichment investment that the Congress has just appropriated are all critical enablers. Maybe I should say enable. I just messed up my own metaphor there. But once the U.S. government shows up and the industry starts to perform and de-risks this for private capital because of the demand out there, and because just to take AI alone, you have multiple trillions of dollars of net present value that are for the taking, I think the private sector, there's lots of dry powder out there. And once the private sector has some de-risking at the hands of the government, I think they will be there in force, both debt and equity.
So we've seen the Secretary of Energy along that theme, you know, talk about the need for more private sector investment coming in. And, you know, the government will be there to help things out, but not to, you know, provide all these, you know, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that's eventually going to be needed to, you know, bring that many gigawatts to scale. And we've seen some really good developments. We've seen these Amazon, Google, Microsoft, you know, direct investments in companies or in facilities, which quite frankly, a couple of years ago, we didn't see. I mean, if you go back to even 2023-ish timeframe, if you talk to a data center hyperscaler, they would say, hey, we just want the electrons. We want a PPA, power purchase agreement with whoever's going to produce the power for a nuclear reactor or wherever, and we'll just buy the electricity. Now they're actually investing in companies directly, which I think is going to flow through also to the supply chain. We can only hope. But the question I've got for you is, do you see that momentum continuing to build, or are we going to kind of plateau here? Because a lot of these reactor technologies aren't really proven yet. I mean, they've been proven in labs, but not at commercial scale, especially the Gen 4. Is this something where we're going to see kind of a halt to new investment coming in from the hyperscaler community and others? Or do you see this kind of taking off in a logarithmic fashion?
Well, there's a third option of not logarithmic, but steadily increasing. I would say, frankly, I think it would take a black swan event to stop it now, because I think the appetite for more 724 reliable carbon-free energy is essentially limitless. And they've already, and it took a long time. I had myself a number of conversations with yours, and it's actually surprisingly recent, as you just indicated, that they got the memo, so to speak, that this, there's just no way. There's just no way. I used to, you know, they used to wrap themselves in the flag, no disrespect to renewables. Oh, we'll be all renewable by 2030 and so on and so on. And I go like, it's so nice. You don't have to run those data centers at night.
Yep.
So all of a sudden they realize, oops, you know, and now they want gas, they want coal, right? They need what they can get. So as long as, and this is very, very important, Jim, industry performs. So, I mean, if there's another Black Swan event, hopefully there won't be, that could stop things. Or if industry like messes up in a serious fashion, that could stop things. But if industry is able to execute, then I think this will continue. And I think, you know, the scalability is a huge issue. It is no mean feat to add either 200 or 300 gigawatts based on 100 gigawatts we already have installed between now and 2050. But it's not crazy. You know, I looked it up. I want to check this out, but I think in 1973, we had 50 reactor construction sites going at the same time. Certainly, we added an enormous amount of nuclear to the grid between 1970 and 1990. So if we had to do this, we could do it. But it does come back time and time again to industry stepping up to the plate with the supply chain and the workforce and hitting their marks.
And I think the government is doing some pretty smart things in offering other benefits such as land, you know, where hyperscalers or others can build their data centers on a federal property. It might lead to regulatory quickening, which would be good. But if you put, for example, a military base, you put some data centers on there, some of these high priority data centers, you've got your security force built in, you're out of sight of the public mind. So you can then power both the military base and the data center using the same reactors. It seems like a pretty smart way to move forward. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
No, I think that'd be brilliant. One of the interesting questions, I was just talking to a colleague the other day, you know, if you build the nuclear reactor on a military base, it can be regulated by DOD and or DOE. And to the extent that, again, no disrespect, but the NRC is slow, you can speed things up. I think, Jim, there used to be a theory that if one electron goes off of that base to the civilian grid, that NRC obtains jurisdiction. I believe that intelligent folks have been looking into that, and I don't believe that that is statutorily required. And I think people are looking hard at, you know, whether, and it makes sense when you think about it, if there's a predominant purpose that is being served for national security on a military base, and, you know, you're providing some electrons also to the grid, the commercial grid, doesn't seem to me it sort of swamps the whole regulatory predicate of having the U.S. government basically regulate the safety. And the U.S. government has decades, obviously, you know, DOE has had decades of effective regulation of U.S. nuclear operations. So, yeah, I think that's a great idea.
So you've also talked a couple of times about the need to deploy more than one, you know, multi-unit deployments of reactors, or fleet, as they might call it, deployments of reactors. And obviously, you're going to have much lower, you know, supply chain costs once you get your supply chains established, you know, get over that first of a kind hump. What are the government policies that you're looking for to help kind of enable industry to go to multi-unit deployments rather than just onesies and twosies?
Well, there's two things. Number one, you know, there's this, again, sort of cliche, government is bad at picking winners and losers. So I used to say when I was Deputy Secretary of Energy, I would rather do 100% of one project than 10% of 10 projects. And we have this tendency to just fund too many things. Now, one of the great things about Admiral Rickover, and you know this very well, is many of these so-called Gen 4 concepts, they were already there in the 1950s, right? We know it. Molten salt, liquid metal. And he says, that's nice. You guys keep doing all that research. I need one, so I'm picking the light water reactor because it fits on a submarine. And boom, we've got over 90 of those on ships, and we've got, you know, 94 of them commercially deployed. So you can't let 100 flowers bloom. So I would say, with all due respect to my old department, Department of Energy, you know, the Advanced Reactor Development Program funded 10 reactors. Like, that's probably too many, right? And they got $3.4 billion from Congress, and Congress also gave them a 2028 deadline to stop importing enriched uranium from Russia, and they put out 10 $2 million grants. So this is not how you get anything done, right? So one thing, let's not dissipate our taxpayer resources too widely. There are ways to have a selection process that somebody has to bid for an RFP and they have to show capability or they have to bring in private capital. There are ways that the government does not have to take the whole burden of picking winners and losers, but can still have a more focused effort. And the other thing I mentioned earlier, which is DOD and DOE should just buy a bunch of them, right? So we should use that power. When you look at the overall budgets of the U.S. government and you look at the requirements, I think that those are the two things I'd recommend. Number one, a more focused approach to deploying the taxpayer dollars that are available for the purpose. And secondly, using the purchasing power of the DOD and the DOE to actually buy in fleet quantities.
Yeah, and we at UCAN totally agree with that. We have postulated that under this Advanced Nuclear Power for Installations program that DOD currently has, that may get modified, you know, with a new program office being stood up at the Pentagon to kind of oversee nuclear within DOD. That's part of the executive orders. But we think that they should be looking at least 10 bases on which to put things, you know, similar to what I guess we must have stolen this from your book. But we think, you know, 10 and maybe as many as 15 or 20, that would allow you to get the kind of fleet level deployments. And you don't have to have just one reactor on a base. You might have four smaller reactors, which gives you some sort of operational flexibilities to keep the 999 or the quadruple nine, you know, reliability factor you need for a data center if you're going to put that data center on the base as well. So I do think there's a lot of promise here moving forward through DOD and DOE and the private sector working together. I did want to ask just two more really important questions. First, real quickly, as far as the regulatory side on the purely civilian with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a lot of great enhancements with the ADVANCE Act and others. Are we headed in the right direction there, or is it just...
I think we are heading in the right direction, but I would say we still have a long way to go. I think the ADVANCE Act was very good. I think that the new mission statement of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which acknowledged the importance not just of regulating safety, which is critical, but also enabling the deployment to serve the nation's requirements, that was good. But, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and changing the DNA of a whole organization takes a lot of work, right, and takes time. And that's why the executive order, I think, is actually well-placed in terms of trying to accelerate that process. Clarity of mission is super important. You know, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And that's why I do believe that now confirming that the NRC is responsible not purely for safety with blinders on, but also for ensuring the safe deployment of nuclear so we, you know, don't have just two reactors, built in 30 years. That's critical. I think getting past the notion that more red tape equals more safety is important. I think the importance, as the EO has spelled out, of science-based and risk-informed regulation is critically important. So I think we also should modernize our processes and make good use of IT and AI to see if, you know, we can do things without 12,000 pages, you know, for a bolt or whatever, you know, we're talking about. And some of these things are just really become encrusted with excessive not safety related regulations. So on the right track for sure. In the bag, not yet. Long way to go, but I think a good start.
Super. We've had a prior guest from INL who has talked about their modeling shows that they can save at least 21% on costs and timing by using AI tools for the licensing in the licensing process. So I do think that's an area ripe for exploitation. But we cannot end this conversation without talking about the fuel supply chain, which I know is a great passion of yours. What's your evaluation of the U.S. nuclear fuel supply chain right now, and what do we need to do to move things forward?
Broken. That's my one word, broken. You can look at the charts, and you can see the vertiginous drop of U.S. natural uranium production, of U.S. enrichment capacity, and conversion was, as you know, shut down for a number of years. So again, I think the executive orders are well placed to address this. I'll just I know we don't have forever and a day on this topic. I will just focus on the one thing I've spent a lot of time. That first memo I wrote for John Glenn in June 1975 was on uranium enrichment, Jim, asking the effect of tails assays and TVA electricity rates on the natural uranium requirements. And my question to my boss was, what's a tails assay, right? So, so let's talk about that. So look, the United States invented that technology. We dominated the world in it. We used it for not only our national security purposes, but we became the dominant commercial supplier. When I started for John Glenn, we probably had 90% of the world market, everything out of what used to be called the Soviet bloc. When I worked for President Bush at the National Security Council, we had 40% of the market. When I became Deputy Secretary of Energy in 2009, we had 25% of the global market. And then in 6 months, we went to zero because of the end of an arms control program called Megatons to Megawatts, which we can talk about on another occasion, and because they had to shut down the last plant at Paducah after Fukushima clobbered the market. There's only four major suppliers of enrichment, and they're all state-owned enterprises: Russia, China, France, and a European consortium known as Urenco. America needs an enricher, period, full stop. And we need one that can supply national security purposes, and there is a European-owned plant in New Mexico. They cannot legally provide national security material for the Department of Energy submarines and for the tritium for our weapons. Neither could the French company that's talking about building in the United States as well. So we need a U.S. capacity. Congress, in its wisdom, and I'm not being sarcastic, in its wisdom, appropriated $3.4 billion for this purpose to get a U.S. plant built, and they put a 2028 deadline, as we already talked on this broadcast, of getting rid of our dependence on Russian imported enriched uranium. Let's get on with it. The DOE should, like, right away deploy that $3.4 billion and not spread it around 10 companies. I'm not saying it should be sole sourced. It shouldn't be sole sourced. You should have competition for sure. That protects the taxpayer. But it should be an American supplier with an American supply chain, American jobs that can support American national security requirements. And they should do it like immediately without the money's already there. It's been appropriated. They now have an executive order. I think they should do this like with all deliberate speed.
Well, those are words of wisdom. And I'd like to get some more words of wisdom, though. But first, you have to unpack your crystal ball and polish it up and look into it. Where is the American nuclear industry in 5 years?
Look, in 5 years, I see several reactors being built in the United States, both large and small, to the point you raised of the reference in the executive order a few minutes ago. My crystal ball, which has got a little bit of fairy dust, I hope that will work, has an enrichment plant up and running and satisfying U.S. and also our foreign customer requirements for both this high assay, low enriched uranium that the Gen 4 advanced reactors need, but also low enriched uranium that our existing fleet requires. And I would see a slew, and this also came out of the executive orders, of new agreements for peaceful nuclear cooperation with other countries, so-called 123 agreements, because over 30 governments have pledged to triple their nuclear capacity by 2050, and Russia and China are all over the map. And I've talked to people in many other countries, and they keep saying to me, where are you guys? Where are you guys? Well, we need to be there. And I think we need a new attitude on our nuclear exports that doesn't hold ourselves out to some fantastical standard that no one else even asks for and gets into cooperation with these governments so that we can shape and influence. It's a 100-year relationship when you get into a nuclear relationship with these countries. So I see those are the things. Domestic build, enrichment plant up and running, and a bunch of agreements internationally.
Well, we've really kind of run the gamut in this conversation, and we're going to have to get you back for a part two sometime in the future, maybe after the dust has settled from the executive orders and we get into the take action phase. But are there any final thoughts you'd like our listeners to have?
Well, I mean, obviously you can tell this is a passionate interest of mine. I think restoring U.S. nuclear leadership is a categorical imperative for our energy future, for our energy security against possible threats from foreign competitors and adversaries, for non-proliferation the world over, and to combat climate change. And I cannot improve on Bill Gates' one-line case for nuclear power as the only carbon-free energy source that can reliably deliver power day and night through every season, almost anywhere on Earth, that has been proven to work on a large scale. That's the case. And we just have to, I guess my final admonition to all of us out there is, let's just get on with it. I got to leave you with one historical analogy, because again, I know Jim from the past and we're both big history buffs. So at the end of World War I, the American army demobilized. Everyone knows that, right? And then 1940, Hitler is romping around Europe. You can mobilize people. But less known is that the U.S. Army also demobilized its horse breeding program at the end of World War I. And those horses towed artillery all around Europe in World War I. So how are we going to move artillery? You can surge people, but horses take a certain amount of time to reproduce, right? So in 1940, the U.S. Army puts out a RFP, a request for proposals, 9 weeks. I need a four-wheeled vehicle that can move artillery in Europe. I'm simplifying a bit. Hence was born the Jeep. And by 1945, there were 640,000 of them. So when we're up against it, Americans get the job done. And we got to do it here.
Well, what a great way to end this conversation. Thank you so much for your insights, for sharing your thoughts on the policy landscape, and the many opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for the advanced nuclear industry. It's a lot to think about. But you did provide a wealth of information. I know our audience would be grateful to hear your views. Thank you very much. And best wishes to you and the entire team at the Nuclear Energy and National Security Coalition for continued growth and success.
Well, thank you, Jim, personally. And thanks to UCAN. You guys have been great partners. And I think we're all in the traces trying to advance the same mission. So it was a pleasure to be with you, and be delighted to come back anytime.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. At UCAN Power, we believe that advanced nuclear technologies are key to powering the American economy in the years and decades ahead. If you feel the same or just want to learn more, please check us out on social media and at www.ucanpower.org. Special thanks to the team at UCAN Power and our producer, Ms. Kimberly, for her dedication to this podcast. Like Edison inventing the light bulb, Ms. Kimberly never quits, and the end result illuminates our little slice of the world. Till next time, this is your host signing off with thanks to you for tuning in to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast.